From the Land de Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 13th day of January 2023. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlow, GlobalComResearch.com, out of Atchison, Kansas, and Eric Snodgrass will join us to discuss the agricultural weather. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Along the way, I'll update you with the agricultural news for the afternoon, and if you can stay with us for the whole of the hour, you'll hear all of our Commodity Week program with our panelists this week, including Brian Stark of the Andersons, Sherman Newland of Risk Management Commodities, and Dale Durkholz of Grain Cycles, all on this ag programming that comes to you from Illinois Public Media, online at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn today settled at $6.75. It was up 4 cents. The May at $6.73 3/4, 4 1/4 higher. In December, the new crop there at $5.98 1/2, up 2 1/2 cents for the afternoon. March beans at $15.27 3/4, up 9 1/4. The May at $15.27 1/4, up 8 cents. And November soybeans down 3 1/4 at $13.93. Bean meal $5 lower at $476.30 a ton. The bean oil at $63.06, down 19 cents. Wheat futures soft red up 1 at $7.43 3/4, and the hard red at $8.43 3/4, up 8 3/4 on the afternoon. Live cattle futures at $160.90, 2 1/2 cents lower for the day. The feeders at $182.87 1/2, $1.40 higher, and lean hogs per 100 pounds at $87.27 1/2, a dime higher on the afternoon. Some of the outside markets: crude oil at $79.76 a barrel, $1.37 higher. U.S. diesel fuel or heating oil at $3.26, that's 4 1/10 cents higher. And gasoline at $2.53, about 0.4 cents higher. Natural gas down around 18 cents at $3.17 1/2. For the day. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 34,333. That's around 12 points higher. The S&P 500 at 4,006.5 points, up 3.25 points. We're now joined by Mike Zuzlow. He's at GlobalComResearch.com. It's been a busy week, Mike, but really, things haven't changed that much.
Well, let's start there, Todd. I think you bring up a good point. We've seen some changes and some maneuvering through the spreads. You know, the hard red wheat spread against the soft red wheat spread, we're back above a dollar. The new crop corn seems to be performing a lot better against the new crop beans because of the report. And I think, you know, this makes sense fundamentally from a winter wheat seedings report number when it came to the hard red increases versus massive soft red increases. And also given the fact that not only did we lose, you know, 185 million bushels of corn total demand, we actually saw the current ending stocks figure yesterday actually go down 15 million bushels thanks to that harvested acreage, massive harvested acreage drop. And I think these are the things that the trade, you know, is working through on the spreads. And so I'm wondering, and I think this is the case, we'll find out next week, I'm wondering if the three-day holiday, along with the outside markets, are still the two things that the trade's waiting to find out more about. In other words, calendar, timing, why take a position aggressively before a big holiday in the United States markets? Why go after it when you're right on the cusp of taking out a major support in the dollar and taking out major resistance in the crude oil market? So that's what I'll be coming back to when we come back from the holiday trade.
Yeah, so Martin Luther King weekend, no trade on Monday. We'll be back on Tuesday the 17th for this three-day holiday. And just as a reminder, that yesterday's reports, as you mentioned, changed the ending stocks for corn just down 15 million bushels, ending stocks for soybeans down 10. There were a lot of numbers as you went through that changed to get us there, but the bottom line wasn't that different. We'll get through the holiday week. What are the things you'll be watching as we start trade on Tuesday then?
Well, the thing that I think I remember about talking about the last commodity week we were on together, I was talking about how the charts were ready, looked like they were ready to break one way or the other, and that the market fear was increasing regarding China. And we needed the macro markets to support us, especially if we didn't have USDA data to support us. And by default, we needed USDA data to support us. And we got that. And so you can sit here on a Friday afternoon and say to yourself, if you were short corn or wheat because you were worried about the ending stocks going up because of weaker demand, you don't have a very good reason being short corn or wheat at this point. And I'm talking like big picture, not how we trade the next 48 hours. The second thing is, and probably the most important thing is the Asian markets turned very abruptly back very positively right after that last commodity week. And we have seen some travel data that suggests that the Chinese are really getting out to travel, and that their Lunar New Year and their longer 40-day holiday celebration that's wrapped around the Lunar New Year could be very, very strong, maybe, you know, 20% better than last year, still below pre-pandemic levels, but a real jump. And I think that really helped us as we closed out the week for my analysis, because I'll go back to those same charts that we talked about at the commodity week. They are still wedging, and we did not break through support after the USDA report and after these macro factors. So we can breathe a sigh of relief. Now we just have to keep that momentum going that the Asian markets are going to continue to be strong, because if they are, and crude goes above $80 and the dollar breaks through a 2021 trend line, I think you do have some potential for some commodity index buying.
I suppose human nature that we really haven't talked very much about at play there, meaning that, well, the numbers coming out of China as it's related to COVID and the uptick after they opened up, an uptick is a very, very mild term for what has been a very, very bad movement in that direction in China, that human nature was ready to rock and roll after nearly 3 years of being inside and locked up. And I guess that means they've got a lot of folks moving around, and the economy should start to chug along fast.
Yeah, and that is a really interesting point you bring up, a very valid and accurate point. And you contrast that with what I would describe the month of last half of December, first half of January so far as a very shallow-minded trade. And that's why they've been whipsawing us around. And I sit here and I think to myself, okay, we'll get some better travel data, but is it really going to make a big splash in terms of commodity demand? And I think that's why I'm relying so heavily upon the crude and relying so heavily upon the dollar, because they're always so important. I think it's really key that we don't embrace too aggressively the idea that China is healing. I think the trade is thinking that the government of China is going to throw so much money at the market, they're going to create unbelievable inflation. But that is now starting to be priced in. And that's great, but that may be one of the best rallies to sell into, too. And I think we really got to balance that when we come back next week.
Yeah, so there'll be a lot of things that we need to talk about next week and to move through. Farmers stand aside for the moment in that case, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wrote yesterday to clients and subscribers. Let's see what the outside markets want to do, and let's see if that provides a tailwind to allow it, what was, I thought, a bearish report for beans, both in terms of exports going down and the world-ending stocks meeting my expectations and going above 103 million metric tons. And a little bit better weather to look forward to, I think, in the next 5 to 7 days, and especially southern Brazil. These are things I think that are going to probably have to play out. So I'll go after the beans pretty aggressively if we don't see the tailwind from the macro markets generate a wheat led, especially a hard red wheat led rally that supports the corn and then supports the beans as well.
Thank you very much.
You bet, sir. Thanks, and have a great weekend, Todd.
You too. That is Mike Zuzulo. He is with GlobalCommResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, a bipartisan group of House Republicans and Democrats passed a ban on U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve sales to China yesterday, following what was a raucous debate over President Biden's energy policies. 113 Democrats joined all 218 Republicans to pass the Petroleum Reserve China ban. Just 97 Democrats voted no. The naysayers, led by New Jersey's Frank Pallone, blamed Republicans for soaring energy prices, now, of course, eased, plaguing everyone from commuters to farmers over the last 2 years.
Prior to 2015, when the Republicans lifted the ban on exports of crude oil, we had that ban in place for 40 years. And then in 2015, they came in and they lifted the ban. So they caused this problem. And during the Trump administration, the amount of crude oil that was sold to China was unbelievable.
Democrats argued the GOP bill failed to go after other adversaries like Iran and North Korea and would go nowhere in the Democrat-controlled Senate. But Republican leader Steve Scalise blamed the president for waging war against American energy.
President Biden was okay with pipelines from Russia to Europe, but he said no on day one to a pipeline from Canada to America. So all of these actions had a cost.
That is, Scalise slammed a stack full of Biden regulations on the table in front of him.
Department of Energy went after American energy. Department of Energy Regulatory Commission. The Securities and Exchange Commission through woke policies going after American energy. The Department of Agriculture, yes, went after American energy in these rules and regs. The Council on Environmental Quality. The Department of State.
Adding EPA and the Departments of Justice and Interior, arguing depleting the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or SPR, forced the president to plead with adversaries, including Saudi Arabia, to pump more oil. Two other items for the day. From 2015 to 2021, the median total household income for commercial U.S. farms rose an estimated 16% to $278,339 from $238,994. Commercial farms earn more than $350,000 in gross farm income, regardless of the principal operator's occupation. USDA's Economic Research Service reports that in 2021, the median total household income for commercial farms remained above the median income of $75,000 for all U.S. households. Farm households rely on a combination of on-farm and off-farm sources of income. On-farm income is determined by farm costs and returns that vary from year to year. And in any given year, a majority of farm households report negative farm income. And finally today, the United States Department of Agriculture has sent the Census of Agriculture to farmers across the nation, and they are urging them to fill it out, either through the mail and or online. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Let me take a moment now to thank everybody who made it out to the Illinois Farm Economics Series this week in Mount Vernon, East Peoria, and DeKalb. We had really good participation from the crowd. Each of them asked a bunch of questions out loud, more frankly than any of the series I've hosted over the last three decades. It was a fantastic event. If you missed it, no worries. Coming up starting next Thursday, January the 19th, the Farm Doc team will hold a series of six webinars reviewing some of the information presented at the Illinois Farm Economics Summits. You can sign up for those right now at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. That's farmdocdaily.illinois.edu for a series of six Illinois Farm Economics Summit webinars. Let's check in now, as we usually do on Fridays, with Eric Snodgrass. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Hi, Eric. How's the beginning of the year gone for you?
Well, it's been an interesting one because, you know, we still have a La Nina, but the atmospheric behavior since the very end of December, after that colder outbreak, has been very El Nino-like. And what I mean by that is the jet stream has been in an incredibly high momentum state. It's come right off of, you know, Japan and come all the way to the East Coast of the United States, and it's targeted California. So let's just do this. Let's just talk for a moment about what we've seen. So California has received a tremendous amount of precipitation. It's been devastating in some regards, but it has, I mean, Lake Oroville, one of their biggest reservoirs since this all started, has come up 90 feet. So, I mean, the water that's coming into the West is huge. It's going to be important for the entirety of 2023. We've then seen systems come out over the Rocky Mountains, and they've delivered good moisture to the Mississippi River Basin. We saw, of course, some truly epic fogs across parts of the Midwest, the upper Midwest, and northern plains, because some of the snow that was there, combined with the very, very warm conditions we've seen, to melt some of it and really saturate the lower atmosphere. That's interesting. A lot of folks are asking me, hey, if I see fog now, do I expect to see rain in 90 days? There's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy there. Okay, 90 days from now is the middle of spring, so we typically have rain anyway. But a lot of folks are just thinking about that. Then we had the severe weather, and the severe weather in the South yesterday was, I mean, there were 45 tornadoes, over 300 reports of severe weather damage, and we're still adding those up today as we watch this go forward. But there was thunder in Illinois, thunder in Indiana, some in the Eastern Corn Belt, and a lot of folks are saying, if I hear thunder in January, I know I'm going to hear rain in June. And so a lot of folks are seeing this very active time period, and what's interesting is they're associating a lot of it with what typically happens when there's an El Nino fully in charge. And we don't quite have that just yet. We still have La Nina with a grip on this pattern. But the drought area has been reduced. It was at 85%. It's now down to 66%. But I'm going to tell you, the drought that's anchored in the southern plains, that's the one area that's just missed almost all of this, is getting deeper and deeper. And that's going to be an area of concern all the way probably till April or even May.
So you talked about a really busy beginning of January. What's the next 15 days or the end of January look like?
Well, we have two systems rolling through our neck of the woods in the next 5 to 7 days. And as they come through, they're mostly going to be rainfall events for us. We're still 2 miles to get into some colder air. But on the backside of this, the second system next week might be able to bring in some snow back to the Western Corn Belt. Not us, but I think the Western Corn Belt's currently the targeted area. So we have relatively mild conditions, which means a lot of this moisture is going somewhere. It's getting into the soil. That's all a really positive signal. But the end of that 2 week time period looks a little drier for us, and it also looks to finally be a little colder. You know, we've been on this pace where likely the first, 13 days of this year may rank us in the top 7, maybe top 10 warmest starts to any January on record. But the atmosphere is about to just pull the switch on us, and maybe toward the end of this month, really start to deliver some of that really cold air again. That's not anytime soon. We'll still be talking about it next week, but there's going to be some colder air coming in very soon.
You talked about El Nino and La Nina. Mm-hmm. First, what's the difference between the two? And then tell me a bit more about the La Nina that's in place.
Yeah, it's the La Nina and El Nino, kind of the things that we use to define them is a lot of times ocean temperatures. So if there's cold water in the equatorial Pacific, we call that La Nina. If there's warm water there, we call that El Nino. And what it actually is, though, is that the ocean temperature patterns are symptomatic of what the trade winds are doing. All right, so here it is in a nutshell. If there's a La Nina, we almost always are talking about cold winters, snowy winters, hot, dry summers. If there's an El Nino, we're talking about mild, wet winters and, generally speaking, wetter growing season. So most farmers around here love it when we're talking El Nino and worry when we talk La Nina. We've had La Nina for 3 years. This one is slowly fading. It's lost its grip. And what that means is likely going into spring, we will see a bit tighter planting windows than if we had a full-blown La Nina going into spring. We're going to lose a La Nina. Tighter planting windows are the biggest concern for us at that point.
What do we see in South America?
Well, they're kind of watching the same behavior. La Nina and El Nino affect their weather more in Argentina than in Brazil. And in Brazil, really good rains plus a fast planting are leading to what is projected to be an absolutely enormous crop. Some of the drier regions in southern Brazil, like Rio Grande do Sul, you could put Illinois inside of Rio Grande do Sul just to kind of give you a size scale here. You know, that particular state in southern Brazil was incredibly dry. They're finally forecast to get some rains, but it's like us being dry all spring and early summer and then getting rains after, you know, July 15th. So it's going to continue to be problematic down there. Argentina is the really rough spot. They still have another 7 or 8 days before the models even think about bringing in some moisture into Argentina's main growing areas. So that's going to be, continue to be a problem. But safrinha crop's going to go in fast. You'll see that happening over the next month or so.
Anything else?
No, those are the big things. I do want to say, you know, it's not a four-letter word, but it feels like it. I just want to let you know that next week the polar vortex will undergo its first major disruption this year. And when that happens, you know, sometimes usually 2, 3, 4 weeks after it occurs, we see a real link up with cold air coming into the eastern half of North America. So I just want people to not sit here and think that winter was over because it's been so mild, even though we got a little snow on the ground in central Illinois this morning. It's remember, we still have the whole second half to go.
February is synonymous with brr.
Yeah. I'm glad it only has 28 days.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
You bet.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible and joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.